Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I just want to thank you all for coming tonight, and I know you're going to be so glad you came. We're so excited to have Thais Alissi here with her new, much acclaimed debut novel, Ghana Must Go. Thais was born in London and raised in Brooklyn, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. She graduated from Yale with a degree in American Studies and holds a master's in philosophy in international studies from Oxford. How many of you have read Ghana Must Go? Have any of you read it yet? Oh, yeah. I know. Well, you're really in for a treat. The people in this book, this family, they're the kind of book that you read, the characters that stay with you, and you think you live with them for a while, and you think you know them, and you worry about them, and you see their mistakes and their foibles, but you're just rooting for them all the way. I was actually lucky enough to, a month or two ago, before the book came out, some of us booksellers were fortunate to have dinner with Thais and her publisher at Penguin. And so I got to hear about you, and there's a background of her family, too. Her mother is currently a pediatrician in Ghana and from there, and both your parents are from West Africa. Your dad's from Nigeria, right?
The other way.
The other way. Oh, and she's just, but she is practicing. Okay. The other way around. And but these are just little pieces, and you'll see these little pieces woven through the book, paralleling a little bit of Thais' life. But the book is fiction, and it's a fascinating look at a family of four children growing up with a doctor who the whole family, in their own different ways, makes big sacrifices for each other. They love each other. They're not always the best sacrifices that they make, but it's a book you really don't want to know too much about. You want to just dive in and let it carry you. So with that said, will you please join me in welcoming Thais Alissi? Thank you.
Thank you. So this is my first ever book tour, and this is the fifth stop of 17 on my book tour. And I've learned in the short time that I've been on the road that I don't really like to read standing up because it reminds me of being in grad school. It's just like I'm giving a lecture, and I was like, the whole point of becoming a writer was so that I could leave that dark past behind. So instead, I'm going to sit here sort of like fireside chat style, holding the microphone in one hand and the book in the other. So it's true that I'll just tell you a little bit about the book and then I'll just jump right into it. My family is more or less West African. My mother is actually Scottish and Nigerian and lives in Ghana, and my father is 100% Ghanaian from Ghana, but he lives in Saudi Arabia. And he's been there my whole life. And my twin sister is a doctor, and she is in Baltimore, and I live in Rome in Italy. So, amongst other things, I have a lot of frequent flyer miles. And I think a sort of a lifelong experience with complicated, global, diffuse, diverse, dramatic, loving families. So I'll read from near the beginning. The book is in three parts. Part one is called Gone. Part two is called Going, and part three is called Go. So I'll read from part one, Gone. At this point in the novel, Kwaku, the father, has taken a second wife. He has left Fola, the mother of his four children, and he's reflecting on their relationship. Okay. Where are his slippers? In the bedroom, he considers. His second wife, Amma, is asleep in that room. Plum brown lips slipped apart. the plump inside pink showing, and he doesn't want to wake her. A wonder, the change. Quite apart from the performances for himself and his cameraman, there is this new and genuine desire to accommodate his wife. It's as if he's a different, kinder man in this marriage, which that other woman would argue is not his second, but his third. That other woman is lying, and the both of them know it. They were never close to married, though she'd lived in his house. He'd been desperate for warmth, for the weight of a body, the smell of perfume, even cheap Jean Nate. The thing had gone bust when she'd broken her promise to leave the apartment that morning in May, so as not to see Olu, who'd come for his birthday at last and who left at the first sight of June. With Ama, whom he married in a simple village ceremony, her incredulous extended family members watching, mouths agape, he is gentle in a way that he wasn't with Fola. Not that he was brutish with Fola, but this is different. For instance, if he raises his voice and Ama flinches, he stops shouting. Without pause, like a light switch, she flinches, he stops. Or if she passes by his study door and coughs, he looks up, no matter what he's doing, what he's reading. Ama coughs, he stops. His children used to do the same intentionally, just to test him, to weigh his devotion to his profession against his devotion to them. By then, he'd moved the sextet to that massive house in Brookline, a veritable palace, although his study door, an original, didn't close. They'd loiter in the hall outside the half-open door, giggling softly, whispering loudly to attract his attention, then peer in to see if he'd look up from reading his peer-reviewed journal, which he wouldn't, to teach them. It was a logically flawed experiment. He'd have told them if they'd asked. His devotion to his profession kept a roof over their heads. It wasn't comparative, a contest, either or, job fee family. That was specious American logic, dramatic, married to a job. How? The hours he worked were an expression of his affection, in direct proportion to his commitment to keeping them well, well-educated, well-traveled, well-regarded by other adults, well-fed, what he wanted and what he wasn't as a child. When Ama loiters noisily, and she is testing him also, Kwegu knows, he marks his sentence and lowers his book. He gestures that she enter and asks if she's all right. She always says yes, she is always all right. And if they're riding in the Land Cruiser and she shivers even a little, he orders Kofi, who started driving, to turn off the AC, though he can't stand the humidity, never could, even in the village. They used to mock him, call him Obroni, albeit for other reasons too. And if he's watching CNN when she comes padding into the living wing in pink furry slippers, pink sponge rollers in her hair, he switches the channel instantly to the mind-numbing cacophony of the Nollywood movies that he hates and she loves, and so forth. Attends church, though he can't stand the hoopla. Buys scented faux soap, though he can't stand the smell. Instructs Kofi to make the stew to her exact specifications, though he can't stand the heat. Weeps to eat it that hot. He wants her to be satisfied. He wants this because she can be. She is a woman who can be satisfied. She is like no woman he's known, or like no woman he's loved. He isn't sure he ever knew them or could, that a man can know a woman in the end. So the women he's loved, who knew nothing of satisfaction, who having gotten what they wanted, always promptly wanted more. Not greedy, never greedy. He'd never call his mother greedy, neither Fola nor his daughters, at least not Taiwo, at least not then. They were doers and thinkers and lovers and seekers and givers, but dreamers, most dangerously of all. They were dreamer women, very dangerous women, who looked at the world through their wide dreamer eyes and saw it not as it was, brutal, senseless, etc., but worse, as it might be or might yet become. So, insatiable women, unpleasable women, who wanted above all things what could not be had, not what they could not have, no such thing for such women, but what wasn't there to be had in the first place, and worst, who looked at him and saw what he might yet become, more beautiful than he believes he could possibly be. Ama doesn't have that problem, or he doesn't have that problem with Ama. First of all, she isn't as smart as the others, which isn't to say that she's stupid, far from. He knows that people talk, that people call the girl simple, and he knows it's cliche, surgeon shacks up with nurse. But he also knows now that his wife is a genius, of a completely different sort than her predecessors were. She has her own form of genius, a sort of animal genius, the animal's unwavering devotion to getting what it wants, to getting what it needs without disrupting the environment, without tearing down the jungle, without causing itself harm. He wouldn't have guessed this a talent at all, but for those smarter women's gifts of self-flogging, self-doubt. Amma doesn't hurt herself. It doesn't occur to her to question herself, to exact from her psyche some small payment of sorrow for all worldly pleasure, though the world demands none. But she isn't a thinker, isn't incessantly thinking about what could be better, about what to do next, about what she's done wrong, about who may have wronged her, about what he is thinking or feeling but not saying, so her thoughts don't perpetually bump into his, causing all kinds of friction and firestorms, explosions, inadvertently collisions here and there around the house. Her thoughts are not dangerous substances. The thoughts of the dreamers were landmines, free radicals. With them, breakfast chat could devolve into war. Amma isn't a fighter. She comes to breakfast without weapons and to bed in the evening undressed and unarmed. She has no vested interest in changing his mind. Her natural state is contented, not curious. And so, second of all, she isn't unhappy. This was a complete revelation. To live in a house with a woman who is happy, who is consistently happy, in her resting state, happy, and who is happy with him, not as an event or a reaction, not in response to one thing that he did and must keep doing if he wants her to remain happy, churning the crank, ever winding the music box, dance, monkey dance, but whom he makes happy, has made happy, and who's miraculously stayed happy, who has the capacity to stay happy with him over time? Never. He didn't know this was humanly possible or womanly possible until 53 years old, when he packed up his tent and decamped to the master wing, but finding it too quiet, one day considered his nurse, and the rise of her buttocks, and the chime of her laugh, and the odd way she tittered and blushed when he approached, and asked if she might like to join him for dinner. This is why he believes he loves Amma. Because she said, "Thank you, I would please." And the same thing again when he asked her to marry him. She always says yes, and is loyal and simple and supple and young because her thoughts don't explode over breakfast. He believes he loves Amma because of the symmetry between them, between his capacity for provision and her prerequisites for joy. Because he finds all symmetry elegant and this symmetry quiet, an elegant kind of quiet here and there around the house. He believes he loves Amma, although he once thought he didn't, thought he cared for and was grateful for, but didn't really love her. And in the beginning he didn't, before he recognized her genius. Because he knows something now about women. He has come to understand his basic relationship to women, the very crux of it, the need to be finally sufficient, to know he's enough, once and for all, now and forever. This is why he believes he loves Amma. He is wrong. Thank you. So that's a little bit from the beginning of the novel, which is told more or less from the point of view of Kweku, who is dying. But this is not a reveal. The first two words are Kweku dies. And then he dies as advertised. So parts two and three sort of unravel the story a bit more carefully. But in part one, Kweku might be the character who dies the most slowly in the history of literature. It takes him a good 98 pages to kick the bucket. But in this moment, he's really moving towards a deep, deep nostalgia for his first wife and thinking about the second one. So I would love to answer any questions you have or hear any comments. I know you haven't read the book, so it might be a bit difficult, but you can make things up. I do it all the time. In fact, I do it for a living. Please.
Well, actually, you partially answered the question I was going to ask when you read that, as far as for perspective, who, what was the person that was narrating this? And so you've answered that.
Have I?
Yeah, the Kaiku.
Well, okay, first thing. My name's Taye. What's your name?
Jim.
I'm confused about who that narrator of Ghana Must Go is. I probably shouldn't admit that into the microphone when it's being recorded for a podcast. But the first part of the novel deals with Kwaku, and then he has flashbacks to different moments in his life. But the narrator of Ghana Must Go is technically, I think we would call, third person intimate. We're never in the first person. We're never in someone's head. This narrator sees the past, the present, the future. This narrator can see into everybody's head when it wants to, and then doesn't understand things when it chooses not. A bit like me. It's very good at willful ignorance, surprising flashes of insight. But the narrator of Ghana Must Go is in many ways the seventh character in the family. Not really belonging to one particular character, but part of and intimate with all.
Yeah, because I was curious. This was, in my impression, sort of an all-knowing, omniscient character or perspective. And what challenges that presented as you progressed in the writing when you had to introduce those who were actually speaking.
Right.
And yet you've created a character that seems to understand the individual characters probably better than they
understand themselves. The challenge that created manifested as a 6-month writer's block between finishing part one and writing parts two and three. It was the voice of the novel is very consistent. There's almost a rhythm to it, a bit of a meter, which I sometimes think may come from the amount of time that I spent studying Latin and translating text, or I studied cello for a very long time. So there's something very musical about the voice. The voice I always understood. But when Kwaku died, finally, and parts two and three were to be written, which is when the family finds out and then comes to Ghana for his funeral, I was really stuck because I felt that I didn't know as much as the narrator knows about these people. I still don't know as much as the narrator knows about people generally. When I met my editor for the first time, she read 100 pages of the novel and then, bless her always, decided to buy it, but she'd never met me. And when I met her, she said to me that she was 90% sure that I was a middle-aged man. And I said, nope, I'm definitely a girl. And I've only been around for 3 decades. And I said, why did you think that? And she said, because of the part that I just read. She's like, it seems like you're writing from some deep understanding of the male psyche and not a young man, an older man. And she said, where does that come from? And I quoted Leonard Cohen then, and I quote Leonard Cohen now when asked where his songs come from. He said, if he knew, he would go there more often. That's completely how I feel. So this narrator knows more about the world than I do. This narrator knows about mothering and fathering and marriage and divorce and childbirth and death. And I know none of this from my personal experience.
It poses an interesting challenge because the reader, as they get to know the characters through their dialogue, have been influenced by this character that seems to know them best, so
there's a tension.
There is a tension.
Exactly, exactly. Thanks, Jim. It's really insightful. Yeah.
Taye, can you talk about the title Ghana Must Go and
sure.
how you chose it?
Sure. I never really choose titles. I think they always choose me. I started this novel in Sweden. I was at a yoga retreat that forbade electronics, so I had to escape and go to Copenhagen where I could use my laptop. And I started writing it, and then I was writing, and then it came time to save that first document for the first time. And I saved it, for whatever mysterious reason, as Ghana Go Home, which is the cousin phrase of Ghana Must Go. So in 1983, Nigeria, known for its level-headed politics, just kidding, expelled 2 million Ghanaians from the country and gave them 24 hours to leave. And in their haste, Ghanaians packed everything that they had in these huge plaid plastic bags imported from China. And as they left, Nigerians, known for their kindness, said things like, "Ghana go home," and "Ghana must go." So to this day, those bags, that plaid plastic print, is known as "Ghana must go." Even in Ghana, we still say like, "Oh, Taye, when you come to Accra, can you bring me a Ghana must go bag full of peanut butter?" Or, you know, whatever the case may be. In my mom's case, Prada bags. But anyway, so you have your Ghana must go bag, and now it's very, we laugh in Ghana because Louis Vuitton made a bag in this print, and then the French designer Celine made a bag in this print. It's just the funniest thing because obviously it comes from a short but bitter moment in intra-regional politics. Anyway, so that's where the phrase "Ghana must go" comes from. I saved the document as ghanagohome.doc, and I left Copenhagen and I went to Lagos to see my mom to celebrate her birthday. And I told her, "Okay, I'm working on this novel." And she said, "What's it called?" I said, "Well, I don't know. I saved the document as Ghana Go Home." And she said, "No, you should make it Ghana Must Go." And I was, it's funny, my mom's a Nigerian living in Ghana. And I said, "Why?" And she said, "I don't know, it just sounds better." And I was so early in the text, I wasn't really wedded to the title at all. I said, "Okay." So I'd save as, I renamed it Ghana Must Go. And then literally 2.5 years later, when we were doing the cover, I said to Anne, "Do you think that's the right title for the book?" And she said, "Absolutely. Number one, because it's what your instinct said. It's what the muse had to say about it. And that is always my standard." I wrote a short story called "The Sex Lives of African Girls." And I was also asked, "Are you sure that's the right title for the story?" And I said, "That's the story. That's the title that came." I mean, that's just what I got. But with Ghana Must Go, I think the way in which that bitter moment in Nigerian-Ghanaian relations became something that Ghanaians now laugh about and joke about, something light and even triumphant, I do think that is resonant with the themes of the novel, to do with taking moments in family history that are heartbreaking, to say the least, and using them as catalysts for reconciliation. Please. Oh, yeah, I'm saying the people who come from the country Ghana are called, in American English, Ghanaians. But for whatever reason in Ghana, we say it with a funny accent, so we say Ghanaians. But I'm really just mispronouncing the word. Yeah, it's that makes me laugh because I live in Rome, and I'm always laughing, I have to say. And I went to see Julius Caesar performed. And there's this line that we've all heard so many times, friends, Romans, countrymen. And it just made me laugh when it was like, "Amici, Romani, Paisani." It's just, yeah, an accent can change everything. I'm saying Ghanaians. I'm saying Ghanaians.
How has this been received in Ghana?
Oh, it hasn't. It hasn't. So the novel is... Jim's question was, how has this novel been received in Ghana? And my answer was, it hasn't yet, because the novel is going to be published in 15 countries, and Ghana falls sort of later in the schedule, number one. But number two, contemporary literature is a growing industry in Anglophone West Africa, which is basically Nigeria and Ghana and tiny little Gambia. And so it's still a challenge. For example, when Chinua Achebe published his memoir in Nigeria, they couldn't meet demand. There just weren't simply enough printing presses in Nigeria to meet the demand for the book. Obviously a lovely problem to have, but we're just trying to find the right publisher that can run off the number of copies because there's great interest. Nigeria is better known in this part of the world for its novelists, but Ghana has a fair few, and I'm happy to count myself half amongst the number. Yeah. Yes.
Another interesting story that you told us that I think everyone would enjoy hearing was about Toni Morrison.
Sure. When I was leaving Oxford, I decided to drop out of my PhD program. I had gotten this master's for no apparent reason. All of my family, to the last, they're all doctors, and I'm innumerate. So I thought, well, I'll go get a PhD, and then I can be a doctor too. But that was obviously a bad plan. So after I did the master's, I thought, okay, I'm going to leave and make my way in the world as an author. And miraculously, at that exact same moment, Professor Toni Morrison came to Oxford to receive an honorary degree. And there was a reception for her at Oxford, as you do. And her niece invited me to come along, and no one would take the seat next to her. She's a little bit scary. So I ended up in the seat next to her. I was a little bit scared. And she very sweetly said to me, you know, what are you doing? And I said, with a full-on stutter. I mean, I was so overwhelmed to be sitting next to her. This is my literary hero. I was like, I want to be a writer. And she said something along the lines of, well, that's easy. Either you are a writer or you're not. It's like, okay, it's not going so well. let me see if I can brush up the follow-up answers. So she was like, well, you know, I like ate some soup sheepishly, and then I tried to resume the conversation, and she said, well, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm leaving Oxford. I'm going to go to New Jersey, and I'm going to try to write. And then she laughed again, and she was like, well, that's ridiculous. Either you write or you don't. I was like, oh, okay, well, great. I'll get back to you on that. And for some reason, my bumbling attempts to explain that I'd always wanted to be a writer, that I'd known that this was my dream since I was 4, but I'd somehow been unable to muster the courage to pursue, touched her in some way, because when I got back to New Jersey, she was living in Princeton at the time, she reached out and I went to her house, and she just gave me the greatest gift that anyone really could have given me, which was a deadline. She said, give me something to read. Give me a manuscript by the end of next year. I'll have published my next novel, A Mercy, in November, at the end of the year. Let's make it New Year's Day. Send me something to read. And my mom was there, my sister was there, her granddaughters were there, so we shook hands. The stutter came back. And then with this deadline from this luminary in my world, I mean, I didn't write anything for 7 months. I tried, but it all seemed inadequate. And then finally I wrote The Sex Lives of African Girls. And I was in Sweden actually trying to make that short story longer when this novel sort of appeared as a whole. So I wrote this novel instead. But I did meet Professor Morrison's deadline. She did like The Sex Lives of African Girls. Thank God. Yes, please. Your name?
Yes, I'm Blake.
Hi, Blake.
So Toni Morrison is someone who I think tends to write a lot about families, as it seems like you have done here. And yet her stories have this like overarching kind of political thing happening too. And just judging by your story of the title of this novel, I would think that there might be something political in it as well.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not right, Blake. You know, Blake's observation, an astute one, and his question were these, that Toni Morrison tends to write novels about families that nevertheless have a sort of overarching political quality. And judging by the story that I just told about the origins of the title Ghana Must Go, rooted as it is in Ghanaian Nigerian history, he was asking, does this work have that kind of political undercurrent as well? Is that a good, more or less? And I said no, that this work, despite its title coming from a political moment, does not seek to engage really in any way with the broader politics of the nation states, the young, growing, developing, evolving nation states of Ghana and Nigeria. Rather, my project here is simply the human being. And I find that these six human beings are so messed up that I had no more energy to consider the problems of the countries whence they come. Really, they 336 pages about their problems was my story, and I'm sticking to it. Of course, though, Blake, you're touching on something that I'm confronted with oft, and that's the tendency of the reading public to take any piece of work from any country in Africa and decide that it's political and speak of the African novel, a phrase that always makes me chuckle heartily. Because I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't mean to be difficult. I really don't know what the African novel is. And I don't know if that would include Mafuz and Kutsie and Chimamanda Adichie or just Sub-Saharan. I don't know. But I do know that, as I've said, a writer comes to the page with an open heart and not an open passport. And for me, the identity of consequence is the writings and not the writers. So that's I suppose that is my own little tiny politic. That in a way, I guess, writing a novel about West African people that is only about their peoplehood may be political unto itself.
Hey, hi.
Hi.
What's an important thing or two that your parents passed on to you?
An important thing or two. Amongst the innumerable things that my mother in particular passed on to me, the three that come immediately to mind. Number one, my mother is a pediatrician, and she trained in Zambia. And then when she came to the United States, she had to do her residency all over again, which is very difficult as a physician who's been practicing and is quite highly regarded in her field to come to the States. I don't know if you guys know about Grey's Anatomy. I mean, being a resident in the States is slave labor. And to do this as an adult with two children, I think, was very, very difficult for her. But she did it because she was determined to raise us here, and she was determined that we would have access to all of the opportunities that she herself was denied. And I think from just watching that, she never bemoaned it. She never really said much about it. But seeing my sister now as a resident and really understanding what it was that my mother was doing on our behalf, I think it's just taught me the profundity of the importance of a vision. Just my mom had this vision that she had these two daughters and we were going to have it all. And she never wavered from it. So from my mom, hard work, perseverance, stick-to-itness. But also, funnily enough, my mother is incredibly intelligent, but she's also a very glamorous woman. And when Ghana Must Go was coming into the light of day, my agent took me aside and said, Taye, this is how he talks. He's like, Taye, you're going to have a problem. I was like, really? What's going to be my problem? He's like, well, you're a woman. Exact words. And it shows. I was like, I was like, how would I go about hiding the fact that I was a woman? And he just looked at me and he was like, not like that. So I told my mom this and she said, listen, this paradigm that would have you choose between being a gifted writer or an intelligent person and a feminine woman, reject it. It's not how I raised you. It's not who I am. These things are not mutually exclusive. You just be you. You just do what you do. And it's what she'd always done. And I think this is something else that I learned from my mom. My dad taught me yoga and meditation. Anything else? I promised I'd be brief.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Taye. And thank you all for coming. And
that's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.